for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 667 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is a great Zoot.gg crowdfunding doubleheader. Everything kicks off with Steve McGarry and Rick Stramosky from Mullets, then it all wraps up with Dom Simpson from the Complete Megaton Man Universe Volume 1, the 1980s. Steve McGarry and Rick Stramosky created Mullets, a weekly newspaper strip that's called the funniest comic strip you never read. The series is described this way. They say write about what you know, so Steve McGarry and Rick Stramosky created a comic strip about two idiots. Collected for the first time, there are 60 weeks of full-color dailies and Sundays of the short-lived, much-missed, syndicated newspaper strip Mullets. It also includes a special 12-page bonus sequel by Luke McGarry. We discuss how this strip came to be, who the various characters are, and what we can expect from these creators in the months ahead. The campaign will conclude in the middle of December, but they need your support now, so be sure to do that once you listen to this podcast. Then everything wraps up with my fun interview with Don Simpson, the creator of Megaton Man. This project met its goal in only 4 hours, but would still appreciate your support. Here's the description. Don Simpson created Megaton Man as a one-off superhero parody in 1982 at the age of 21, and swiftly grew his world into an entire universe of interconnected bizarre heroes, characters that continue to spill onto pages and screens to this day. Don tells us how this engaging series came to be, who the characters are, and what else he might have coming our way soon. This campaign will also conclude in mid-December, but don't wait, support it as soon as this episode is over. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they all have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. They say write about what you know, so Steve McGarry and Rick Stramosky created a comic strip about two idiots. Meet Kevin and Scab, two mulleted morons employed at Mildew's Hardware Store by Kevin's long-suffering dad, Kenneth. There's Brittany, the goddess of Register 3 and the object of Scab's unrequited love, and old George, who still has all his marbles but just can't remember where he put them. Collected for the first time, here are all 60 weeks of full-color dailies and Sundays of the short-lived, much-missed, syndicated newspaper strip Mullets, along with a special 12-page bonus sequel by Luke McGarry. Quite simply, it's the funniest comic strip you never read. And I like that last line because that works really well. So I think that's a great thing. So let's start off. Steve, why don't you say hi first so we know what your voice sounds like.
Yes, hi, Steve McGarry here. Thanks for having us.
All right, and Rick, why don't you go ahead and say your voice so we can hear you.
Hi, everyone. How's everyone doing tonight?
All right. Did I get your name halfway right?
No, it sounded fine. Yeah,
okay, you did, Rick. Right. Okay, so I'm always worried about those kind of things. So anyway, Mullets. Let's talk about where this project came from. Because I can take from your accents, you guys aren't in the same part of the world these days. How did Mullets come to be? Who was the person that initiated all this?
Well, Rick and I met in 1996 at the Reuben Awards, the National Cartoonist Society Reuben Awards in New York. We'd never met before. We were both members of the society, and we just got on like a house on fire, just telling each other dirty jokes all weekend and drinking and laughing. And we were just brothers from day one. Yeah. And so for a few years, we kept threatening to do something together. We were both syndicated cartoonists. I'm originally from England. I'd been in the States since 89. Rick's had spent time in California, but he lives in Connecticut. And so we were always looking for a project to do together. And I just came up with, I just called him one day and said, I think I know what it is. And we just went from there. I sort of pitched it to him. And within seconds, in those days, it was fax machines. Within 5 minutes of putting the phone down, the fax machine was whirring. And the characters that we just sort of conjured up over the phone came to life via the fax machine. And so it was just easy. It was just something that was a labor of love that just allowed us to make each other laugh every day and yeah. An excuse to be on the phone constantly.
So where did the characters come from? I mean, the mulleted, we don't hear the word mullet that much anymore. So I'm just kind of curious, where Mildew's Hardware Store and stuff, where is this all located? Where is this taking place?
I think it's just typical middle America, you know, with malls and just, you know, mom and pop stores. It's more like a suburbs, you know, more like a working class neighborhood kind of thing, and something we're both familiar with. But yeah, it was an instantaneous connection with Steve and I when we first met, and also doing mullets. I think it was literally every single day we were on the phone and just laughing hysterically. I mean, it got to a point where my wife would answer the phone. Back then we had landlines, and she said, "It's your other wife is on the phone." And we would just be just laughing all day. I mean, just coming up with these gags and just making each other. And that was the point, trying to get each other to laugh. And it worked quite well. I think we put out a good product.
It's funny. The ones that I got to read now, if you go, by the way, it's at zoop.gg. And if you go directly to the page, it's zoop.gg/C as in cat/mullets, all one word, of course. And if you go there, there are samples of some of the strips in there and stuff like that. Made me laugh out loud. Some of them were quite funny. Okay. And stuff. Well, just great stuff.
Just going on from what Rick was saying there, there's one gag that always springs to mind, because as I say, we were both strip cartoonists, both writing constantly, and I came up with this week. What we try and do is do a theme. For the most part, 80-90% of the strips, there would be a theme. So this week is going to the opticians, or this week maybe they're learning to snowboard, or and in one particular week they were learning that Kevin was teaching Scab to play chess. And so he says to him at one point something like rook to king's pawn 4, and Scab has no idea what he's talking about, and it's a blank look, and he goes, huh? And he goes, rook to king's pawn 4, and there's a beat. And in my original pitch to Rick, I said, and then Scab says base to mission control, which is a good gag. But then Rick went, no, it's ground control to Major Tom. Yeah. It's one of my favorite gags, and it really does sort of encapsulate this idea that we were just sort of basically simpatico, just working together and just making each other laugh and just trying to top each other's gag.
The miraculous thing about that too is that Steve actually gave me credit for that, so I'm happy about that.
Well, it's
in a moment of weakness. Yeah.
Well, I have to say, you know, strips are very structured. You know, you've got to start somewhere and you got to end somewhere, and you have three or four panels to get there. And so if you're telling a joke, you've got to space it out to fit those. You can't have a one-liner. You got to start someplace and work your way to the end. And so it's a very special kind of writing.
Yeah, it's a discipline. One of the things that you'll see, one of the tricks of the trade is that sometimes to sort of underscore a reaction, we'll just do a dead panel. There's a beat where you basically, you fill in the blank and you can see the character's brain working overtime as he tries to figure out, you know, what the situation is. And those sort of beats, those spaces, those pauses, I think are as important as any tagline, because I think it sets the mood for the tagline at the end.
Yeah, it creates a rhythm within the strip, and without that beat panel, a lot of times the gag wouldn't work. It needed some, almost like a pause, you know, for you to catch your breath and think about it, and then boom, the final gag comes in the final panel, the punchline.
Uh-huh. So there are a couple of strips that you can buy. There are several strips, actually, you can buy for $100 each, which is, I think, some of them are classic stuff. The one I like the best, though, is it's George is reading a medical dictionary. And the character goes, "What's that, George? A medical dictionary?" He says, "I want to look up a few dozen symptoms I've been exhibiting. Maybe you should see a doctor." The guy says, "No need. I'm a trained physician now." "What are you talking about? You haven't been to medical school." "No, but I've taped every episode of ER.
Yeah.
And he goes, "That's loco, dude. It takes years of study to become a doctor." "Oh, contrary," says, "not if you fast forward through the commercial."
Yeah.
Oh, I there's so many people I know that when they watch a TV show, especially a medical one, they come and say, "Oh, I've got that. That's mine. I've got that right there. I exhibit those exact symptoms." So that made me laugh out loud. I thought that was a wonderful
thing. Well, in that same week, there's when he's going through the medical dictionary, and Mr. Mildew accuses him of being a hypochondriac, and he denies it. "Of course I'm not." And then at the end, he's worried that he might have got bookworm.
Yeah. That's the other one. That's another one right across the page from him. It says, "I'm not letting you read this medical dictionary, George. You're a complete hypochondriac. He says, "You're right, Mr. M. I'm being silly. How could I possibly get sick from reading a book? Could I just look up the symptoms of bookworm?" Great stuff. So funny. So where did the characters come from? I mean, you've got these two, the basic characters, Kevin and Scab. Where did they come from? Are they based on people you know? Were they creations of your imagination? Where'd they come from?
I think that there's an element of alter ego about it. The thing about the two characters is the Mullet's thing was a sort of a phenomenon that we'd seen, in the 70s when mullets first started. It was Paul McCartney wearing one and then David Bowie wearing one. And you go, "Wow, these guys look so cool." And so people emulated them in the 70s. But by the time it gets to, they're going to expensive hairdressers. They're having their wardrobe done and their hair and makeup done, and you're trying to emulate that in the middle of the country by getting a $5 haircut at the swap meet.
Yeah. So
it doesn't quite have the same Paul McCartney or David Bowie ring. And so we'd seen it, and it was sort of you couldn't flush it away. Every few years the mullet would come back.
Yeah.
So this was, I think it was maybe the second or third time it had come around, and all the wrestlers were wearing it. Every Latin soccer player seemed to be wearing it again, and it just made us laugh. It was just such a dodgy haircut, and I think that was the inspiration. And then we wanted two characters that weren't mean, that weren't mean-spirited. They were just sweet idiots. Yeah. And so it came from there. We needed – it's kind of like a almost osmosis. You kind of draw these things. And we needed a milieu to set them in, and the hardware store is great because we could then have a cast of characters that are trapped in one place. You see it with – any sitcom, they're always visiting each other in the coffee shop or in the bar. Well, mm-hmm. with this, we didn't need to stage anywhere else. We put them in the hardware store. Mm-hmm. And then we could, if we wanted to take them outside of it, that's great. But they kept returning to the hardware store. So it gave us a base, gave us a cast of characters. And as I say, tongue in cheek, we say that, write about what you know. And we wrote about two idiots because... we were just idiots trying to make each other laugh.
Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty much how the genesis of that. Also, too, we did a poster for the sales kit showing all the various different kinds of mullets that were out there. I mean, there wasn't just a singular haircut. I mean, there were several variations on it, and that reminded me of people that I knew. I knew people with mullets. I knew people that had this haircut, and almost there's a culture around it. It's a very blue collar haircut. It's something that, so you see it, NASCAR, and you see it hockey games. Hockey players were wearing this haircut, and so it's like a working class kind of a thing. And I identified the characters, and so that's kind of where that went, and it was just. drawing from people we knew, people that we see out in the world, the culture around it. And one of the things that was pretty obvious when the strip was running in places where it was running, people were saying, oh, I know these guys. This is my brother. Or this is my brother and his idiot friend. Or I went to high school with this guy and or these guys. And so it was it did resonate with people. So it wasn't too difficult to, once we had their basic personalities down, to expand on it. You know, Scab being the complete total idiot, and Kevin lesser so. But it was almost like a Laurel and Hardy, Mutt and Jeff type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I can see it on the Zoop.gg page. There's the tri-state swap meet moratorium, and
right, and see the different.
Oh, yeah,
you have women with them. It would be the female mullet, the femme mullet.
Yeah,
or you have one where there was a mullet hawk, where it was like a mohawk, but a mohawk in the front, and then it would this cascading, you know, hair in the back.
A bald guy would be wearing skullet.
Would be a skullet. Yeah.
The rat tail was another one.
The rat tail, yeah.
I used to see so many kids. I used to coach soccer with my two boys. They were sort of 10, 11, 12, 13, round about the time of this strip. And you would see so many kids with that rat tail, you know, and you'd think, why are you doing that to them? They're gonna look at the photos one day and be absolutely mortified. Yeah. The haircut you gave them.
Well, I've got a couple of questions. Which one is Kevin? Is he the dark-haired or the blonde one?
He's a big, tall. He's a heavy, heavy, tall, dark one.
Okay, so Scab then is the blonde. Okay,
yeah,
so
yes, that's
just
blonde.
So I want people to know exactly who is who. Now, there's a cover, it looks like, for the book, and it's got they're sitting in front of a trailer, watching the television, and there's something that, as somebody who lives in the state of Florida, I'm very familiar with. There's a pink flamingo, like a plastic pink flamingo sitting in there.
Right.
And that makes me think this is taking place in Florida, because if you live in Florida, you see those all over the place.
Yeah, right. Well, we have them in Connecticut here, too. I mean, people have – it was actually – there was a neighbor that was complaining about how many pink flamingos were there in this guy's yard, and he would move them all the way to the boundary bordering his property, you know, just facing this guy's property. But I think this is more of a, you know, it's an old Airstream trailer. Now, Airstream trailers are kind of desirable because of their classic and nostalgia about them. But when I lived in Venice, California, that particular scene I drew from when I lived in Venice. I was on the tail end of the 70s, you know, of when Venice, before it got really commercial and kind of crazy. But we brought our TV and set it out on the lawn and put it on milk crates and watched TV on these, you know, couches that had duct tape on them, and, you know, drank our Pabst Blue Ribbon. You know, I didn't have a mullet back then, but when I drew this scene, this I just drew from, you know, my early days when I was young and stupid and had no future. You know, I was late teens, early 20s. And this is kind of like the experience that I was having at the time. So a lot of it is, you know, from life, you know, the things that we write about in this strip.
So, is one of you the artist, and who's doing most of the artwork? Do you guys share the art?
We went with Rick's art style. I'm a big fan of Rick's art style, but I mean, we're both cartoonists, you know, but I took on the writing duty. Rick was doing the art. And there's other cartoon partnerships. Zitz springs to mind. Mm. Both Jim Borgman and Jerry Scott are both cartoonists. But with Zitz, Jerry was doing the writing, Jim was doing the drawing. And in actual fact, the same thing on Baby Blues, the other strip that Jerry does. Jerry was a cartoonist. He had his own strip. He was the artist on Nancy for years. We just felt that Rick's style lent itself to these characters, so that's what we did. You know, it wouldn't work if we were both trying to draw it. I should tell you,
it wasn't like cut and dried that way, though. Steve would also make suggestions in the artwork or staging. He would send me roughs, like very, very rough pencil drawings, and I would sometimes tweak the jokes. Like, for instance, with the, you know, ground control to Major Tom. So we both had input on everything, but the lion's share of the writing went to Steve and the lion's share of the art went to me. And Steve's wife, Deb, did all the coloring for the Sundays and dailies. So,
yeah, there's a line that that we've sort of appropriated, which is we both did 75% of the strip.
Yeah, kind of like how it worked out, yeah.
I should tell you, as we're talking about that, Rick always Rick always left it up to me. I was always the last port of call. So if you look at the on the page there, there are a number of strips that have the tear sheets with them, and one in particular has my original rough, Rick's artwork, and the tear sheet. So just that'll give you an idea of how we worked. I would send a rough, a very sort of rough thumbnail over to Rick, and then we'd go from there. But that one's in there; you can, it's documented. But one of the things I was going to say was, at every Sunday, we decided that the title panel, which some newspapers just throw away, some newspapers you don't see the title panel.
Yeah.
We decided that we would do a little piece of art there, and we would use a different name every time. So there was one where it's about insomnia. And so it's not by Rick and Steve. It's by Sleeping Beauty McGarry and Rip Van Stromowski. Or I'm trying to think, there's one in the hospital where it's Malingering McGarry and Lead Swinging Stromowski, that kind of thing. And there'd be a little thumbnail sketch to go with it. But the best part about this, so Rick would never know what I'm going to put there, because I would do the title panel after he'd sent the artwork to me. Debs would do the coloring. My wife would do the coloring. And then I'd decide what we were going to be called that week. Uh-huh. But when we did, they flew us to Kansas City for the launch. The syndicate flew us in there. We had a huge launch. And Rick had foolishly allowed me to do the AV presentation.
I dread this to this day, yes.
Yeah. So just to give you an idea of how we amuse each other is I put all the visuals together, and I mocked up at the head of the syndicate, Lee Salem. I basically in Photoshop created a mullet so that I could show the staff, oh, look, Lee used to have a mullet. He didn't, but, you know, I sort of cobbled this together. And I used to be in a rock band, used to play in bands. So there was pictures of me on stage with, you know, a mullet on stage. So I needed a picture of Rick. So what I did was I trawled the internet for the worst example of a mullet I could find. Oh. It was the kid in the picture was, I mean, he didn't look well. His skin was terrible.
He just like me. He had his
own Rick, but it was this kid in a mullet. So the presentation's going. Rick and I are both there. There are 200 people, all the syndicate staff's there, the secretaries, the sales force. Everybody's there, 200 people in this huge room, and we're presenting the new strip to them so that they can go out and sell it. And so I'm going through it, and I show this picture of Lee, and it gets a laugh, and I go, and yet Rick and I both used to have mullets, and I showed the picture of me on stage looking like a rock god. And I go, yeah, I used to be in a band, that's me with a mullet. Click to the next image, and it's this dreadful image. I mean, I can't tell you just how demented this kid looked. And I went, Rick had a mullet in high school, and I just moved on. And so you could see the sort of stunned looks, because nobody wanted to point out that, my God, is that Rick?
And I was stunned. Yes.
He was absolutely aghast. I mean, if you could have seen Rick's face, I don't know how I didn't burst into hysterics there. Was that you?
And not only that, but he milked that at every Rubens for the next 10 or 15 years. Because Steve was, you know, head of the foundation. He was running a certain program. So Steve was on stage a lot. And whenever he got on stage, he inordinately would get to somehow to me and put that freaking picture up. And here's Rick in high school. And it's not me at all. And, you know, people were coming up to me at the break, like Mike Peters, who does, you know, he does Mother Goose and Grimm. Mm-hmm. Comes right up to me and says, was that really you in high school? And I said, no, it's my old friend. taking a piss up my leg every freaking year. It's just like got to be ridiculous at some point.
Oh, it was even better though, because Rick's a very successful. He's won numerous awards as an illustrator of books, greeting cards. And so I had to do some presentation one time, and Rick has got a stream of award-winning books. He's won like 3 or 4 Reuben Awards for his book illustration. But I found one that he did years and years and years ago. It's like a series of health books. And so whenever I would introduce him, I would go, I would introduce somebody, the creator of, it's Patrick McDonald, the creator of the award-winning comic strip Mutts. And then I would get to Rick and I would show the image of this book I'd found. And I would go, and Rick Stromowski, who we all remember from the book Head Lice. And he would be horrified. I'd pick this Rick known for his works on head lice.
Head lice, cuts and scrapes. It was actually a book, Scabs. Just they were health books that I did for some educational materials, and somehow Steve found them, and that became my identity. The author of Head Lice.
I got to ask something here, because there are bios on the Zoop.gg page. Looks like your picture, Steve, is first, and then there's Rick, I think, is next. Are those actually you?
Oh, yeah. No, we're wearing wigs. That was...
Oh,
And there was an Airstream trailer parked in this park nearby where I went. So I went and had that, got my picture taken outside that trailer. And we had mullet wigs and fake tattoos and things. But yeah, those are definitely us.
Okay. And then Luke, is that your son?
Yes. Yeah. Luke's big time Charlie Potato, we call him. He's a very successful cartoonist in his own right. So we shamelessly want to tap into his audience.
Okay, because if you go towards the bottom of that, you get that. And then the stretch goals are in their timeline. They're expecting things to be done about May 25, so we've got a little ways to go for that, but that's good. Now, you guys mentioned something that is actually available on the page, so I got to talk about this because it makes me laugh, because there's the previews, and then you talked about on the title sequence. The first one says Mullets by Starry-Eyed Stromowski and Moon-Faced McGarry.
Yeah. That's exactly what. As you can see, every title panel was completely different. And we just felt it was just a nice little quirk, if you like, of ours.
Yeah, when you put them all together, too, because I think we made like a mini poster or something of it, of just the title panels. And it was so much fun to do, because it related to the gag of that strip, that Sunday strip. And if it was a holiday strip, they would be wearing some kind of holiday garb, or it was a lot of fun to do those. Those are actually one of my favorite things to do in the whole strip, was putting those title pages up there. Cause you could do anything and it could just be really goofy as you want. I mean, there's a few where, there was one where the Sunday page where Scab is the bride of Frankenstein, and Kevin is Frankenstein, and there's just all, they're dressed in, they're either football players, and one of their firemen, or they're dentists, getting their tooth extracted. It was just a lot of fun putting those together.
Well, it's funny, I have to say. Makes me laugh. And sometimes it's the subtle stuff that makes me laugh. The stuff that's in the background that makes me laugh out loud. So it's a funny, funny strip. Now, from what I understand, there are 60 weeks of full-color dailies and Sundays. So let's see, 60 weeks, that's a little over a year.
Yeah, that's what we did. I've talked about this before, but we had huge high hopes. Everybody did for this strip. As I say, the syndicate made it a priority. There was no discussion. As soon as we showed it to them, they signed us immediately. And as I say, flew us out to Kansas City for the launch.
I threw a party at John McNeil's house. I mean, there was a massive party for us at McNeil's house.
But a couple of things. I describe it as storm clouds on the horizon. This was part of the zeitgeist. I don't know. Is how you pronounce it? Zeitgeist? No, it's a word we don't use in Britain. Anyway, this was in the air, if you like. And a few weeks before we were launched, there was a TV series debuted called Mullets, and it was absolutely dreadful. I like to pretend that we were visionaries tapping into, you know, the times, and that the people who did that sitcom were just mercenaries shamelessly cashing in. But it was clumsy, it was awkward, and so it kind of muddied the waters for us.
It was there was an article that came out, an Associated Press article about Nielsen ratings for that particular fall, and the number one worst show was called Mullets. And it was 3 days before our launch.
The other thing, without telling tales out of school, was there was the syndicate hired a new head salesman, and it turned out he was because we were both syndicated with another syndicate. We were both.
I was with United.
Yeah, we were both with United Media at the time, and Rick and this syndicate, he just didn't like Rick's artwork, and so he would never sell it. I mean, it was a bone of contention.
Yeah, he was a head of sales. He just did not like the way I drew. He didn't like my humor for my other strip, Soup to Nuts.
Yeah.
And it ended up – it was supposed to get a launch on its own, but ended up going into the NEA package, which is another kind of a step down from a typical launch. But then he left – well, I'll let Steve finish the story.
Well, yeah, he was headhunted by – Universal, the syndicate we'd take Mullets to. So now suddenly we'd gone from being the golden boys to having this albatross of a sitcom, Hoodie in the Waters. And then the guy, the lead guy on this is Rick's arch enemy. So we were just horrified. And we could sort of see that, you know, that we weren't going to make the numbers that we wanted to. But we'd done about 6 months worth of strips. And so we decided to ride it out. But we came up with a brilliant plan. We had a friend of ours had an editorial cartoon syndicate. And so when we knew that, you know, it was going to be a bit stormy, like the waters were a bit choppy, we asked him, do you mind doing sort of a preview? You know, let people know about this. Maybe we can get some people to write into their newspapers and say that they want to see it. So he pitched it to his audience, and it went insane. We got 5,000 letters, 5,000 emails from people saying, this is the funniest strip I've ever seen. And what we'd asked them to do was write in and tell us what your local newspaper is. We'll collate your responses and send them to the newspaper. So, as I said, we had 5,000 responses. It was just unprecedented. And we gave them to the syndicate, and it still didn't make a dent. I don't know what the salesman did.
I don't know what he did. I don't know what I did to this salesman, but he became I was his target for some reason. I have no idea why.
And he didn't last long. I mean, the brutal thing was that by the time we pulled the plug on this, he'd gone.
Yeah, he left. Yeah, he was gone.
I'm into sabotage us.
Yeah, he just came in.
Different syndicates work different ways, but you know very quickly whether you're going to get any traction. But with some syndicates, they have like a gold, silver, and bronze tiers. So when a strip's launched, in those days, the syndicates would launch three or four strips a year. So you would launch as the gold strip, and for argument's sake, let's say they were, if they sold you, if a salesperson sold you, they got a 50% bonus when you were the gold strip. Well, 3 months later, they would launch another strip, and that, so you would go down the pecking order, you would now become the silver strip, and maybe there's a 25% bonus. And then after 6 months, you become the, you know, another strip gets launched, and you become the bronze strip, and there's maybe a 10% bonus. And then after that, you're just in the herd. And so by the time we hit the nine-month mark, and we were still down to a couple of dozen newspapers, we knew it wasn't going to get any traction. The only way we would have got traction is if somebody retired or died. You know, and then newspapers sort of scrambled to fill it. But with the sales guy we had, even if somebody had dropped dead, there was no way he was going to suggest that they'd pick up our strip. So that's the reason that there's only 60 weeks worth. We decided to do it, you know, we'll do the full year with it. And then we told the syndicate, we just want to pull the plug. And what we did at the end there was we had for 2 weeks, we had the characters auditioning for other comic strips.
Yeah, so
they're auditioning for Peanuts, they're auditioning for Garfield, they're auditioning for
Mutts.
Basically looking to find themselves another job in another comic strip.
Yeah, so, that's a lot of fun to do. Then the very last Sunday was it's an homage to the very last Sunday of Calvin and Hobbes, where they go sledding. Mm-hmm. But instead of, you know, just exploring the world, they're drinking brewskis and eating corn, you know, pig's ears. So, so it's wow.
So that strip had gone. And as we were launching that, I was working with Sesame Street, and I started a Sunday strip called Kid City, which I'm still doing now. It's now called Kid Town. But it's a children's strip. It's puzzles and facts, and so it's not a humor strip. The strip I'd done in Britain, Badlands, the humor strip I'd done there, that ran for 12 years. Rick was still doing Soup to Nuts.
Yeah, that was about 18 years. I did Soup to Nuts.
Yeah, but as I say, so we moved on to other things. I ended, Rick went has done books and et cetera, this sort of stuff. I worked on the Minions movies for some time. I do a lot of sports stuff, and so we've kind of neglected the humor strips, if you like. And so that's why I think this is a sort of a it's going to be a slow burn, because we have to introduce people to a strip that they probably never saw. And they're being introduced to a strip by two artists who aren't doing humor strips at the moment. It's not as though, I'm doing Zits and Rick's doing Baby Blues. We've moved on to other things. But we've got that much affection and love for Mullets that we just wanted to put a coda to it. We just wanted to say, right, this is, we've chopped and tailed it. This is the labor of love. And this is what 60 weeks of it got to do. And we brought Luke in, by the way, because Luke's he's very successful in the music business. He's got a huge following on Instagram. He's very funny, very dark. And we just thought, I think Luke was about 12 or 13 when this strip came out. And we thought, well, we'll get him in and get him to do Where Are the Characters Now 20 years later? And so Luke's take is much darker than ours. I describe it as very Black Mirror. If people have seen the TV show Black Mirror, Luke, that's kind of the waters he swims in. And so the sequel to Mullets, Luke calls it legacy destroying. So it probably is.
Well, that's great, because I find it very funny, and I think a lot of people will. And I have to say that newspaper sales here in the U.S. are not quite what they used to be either. So, I mean, I used to get the newspaper just to read the strips, because I loved them. But nowadays, I think you have to pretty much go online to get this stuff. So a book like this might fill that hole that some people have, that they're not getting to read those funny strips that kind of brighten your day.
And also, I think the fact that it's going to be new to a lot of people. I mean, this is new content that people are going to – that they may not have seen it, but I think people want to read something completely new, at least new to them. So,
and Mullets are back in fashion again. I mean, it is if you look at all the fashion articles again, GQ and all the rest of them, the mullet is back. And so there was a little bit of impetus with that. It was like, well, if you might not have known what a mullet was 5 years ago – young people now know exactly what the mullet is. We would argue that this humor is fairly timeless. It is a funny strip. I mean, we're both professionals. We've both been doing this all of our adult lives. And so we know what's funny, and we know when people are treading water. And because it was the two of us, and because we were, competitive, trying to make each other laugh, we think that these stand the test of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can get the PDF version, the electronic version, for $25, which, is very reasonable price for that. I think the early bird special probably be done by the time I get to that. Was 50.
Yeah, it goes for a couple of days. I think the thing is that to do a book this size, this is a 256-page book, which is twice the size of any cartoon collection that you normally get. We didn't want to do it in two parts. it's this is it. This is the, you know, the book. And so it's a big, thick book. I mean, if you can imagine two cartoon books sort of stuck together.
It even doubles as a jack for your trailer. So
Yeah, exactly.
I've got to ask, though, because the versions, there's a $75 one, but it's signed three times. Then there's a remarked version, and there's a more expensive remarked version. Well, maybe
you can get it signed by, if it remarked, it's basically Rick will do a character sketch, you know, on the inside front cover. And same with Luke. Luke will do a character sketch on the inside front cover. So that's the additional. You can get a version signed by the three of us. There are daily strips with tear sheets, so you can actually see the newspaper in which it was published. Hmm. There are Sunday strips with tear sheets. We've got five of the original press kits. These are the press kits that went out to newspapers 20 years ago. They have a poster. They have these temporary tattoos. They have samples. They're big, thick press kits. So we've got five of those. We've got five copies of a Norwegian magazine that runs American strips. That's purely, it's like a big, thick magazine, and it just runs American comic strips. So we're in there with Foxtrot and a couple of other American strips. So a quarter of the book is mullets. So we've got five copies of that. There are the poster. We've got fridge magnets. You can get 10 temporary tattoos. These are all little add-ons. So there's plenty there to go at. If you're familiar with Luke's work, he's thrown in basically, if you get the book for free, really, if you were going to buy three Luke books or three Luke comics, there's a discount price there now, so you can get the three Luke comics with our book, with the Mullets book, and pretty much, you know, it's a bargain there. Or you can get, it's done another thing where you can get five Luke posters. And if you actually tot up the cost of the posters on his website, it ends up that you get a free book. So that was very generous of him to sort of throw that in. But as I say, it's a kind of a labor of love all around. You know, we want people to see this, and, you know, we hope people will enjoy it.
Now, one of the strips has been bought. Actually, it's a funny one. I guess George goes to a hair place, and a follicle institute, and the guy who's the head of it, his hair looks terrible. Looks like it's been run over by a lawnmower.
Those plugs,
is that what it is?
Yeah, early hair replacement involved taking hair from different parts of your body and literally plugging them into your skull. Much like those rubber dolls that our sisters would have, you know, how the hair, there'd be these little holes with strands of hair coming out of them. And that's what early hair back in, actually hair replacement up until about that time looked like that.
Well, I get a kick, but he's offering, telling them how much it costs. Yeah. And then he gets down and finally Joyce says, still a bit much. What would $50 get me? He says, two coats of primer and a can of touch-up paint, he goes.
The following week, so George goes, he wants a hair transplant. Then the following week, he just buys a wig, but he can't really afford a decent wig. So he buys a wig for, I can't remember what it is, but he buys a wig for sort of $10. But it's held on by a chin strap. He turns up at work with a wig held on with a chin strap. So almost like an aviator helmet.
Oh, funny stuff. See, this is a funny strip, I do have to say. If you want something that's going to be funny and kind of life is kind of a little darker these days, maybe it's time to get out and enjoy some humor and get a very interesting look at life from a different perspective. I think this is a wonderful book.
Well, what we're doing right now is, just so people know, Wayne, every day on our social media, there's a new Mullets gag on there. And the strip itself actually started in late November 20 years ago. So I can't remember what it is, but the last week in November, we're going to start posting it from day one. And oh, wow. The reason we've waited until then is, so for 60 weeks from later in this month, you'll be able to follow the strip as it was. And the reason we've done it that way is that there are strips that deal with Christmas or New Year or Valentine's Day, et cetera, et cetera. And so we wanted it to basically to sync up 20 years later. So there's fresh content every day. I'm just Steve McGarry on all the social media. So you can see it on Instagram. You can see it on my Substack. You can see it on Twitter, Facebook. Rick is, I think you're soup to nuts on most things, aren't you, Rick?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So soup to nuts with a Z.
Okay.
You can link to both Rick and Luke through me. So Steve McGarry on all social media, and you'll be able to see a new mullets every day.
Oh boy, that'd be kind of fun to do. I think that'd be a great thing. Now,
there's some funny ones up there now, to be honest. We've been putting them up the last few days.
Well, what are you guys working on currently? Why don't we start with Rick? Rick, what are you currently working on that we should be aware of?
I started a new middle grade graphic novel series. Called Tater Toes and Schnauzer. They're two dogs. One's a miniature schnauzer, one's a big, tall, fat beagle. And they're best friends, and they're both complete idiots. And they have these adventures where in the first book, Tater Toes wants to see his mother, and they end up going through this forest, getting lost. And they meet all these Mother Goose characters, and they fall into quicksand, and they get chased by hornets, and they get out of trouble using a yo-yo. And in the second book, they go to the Air and Space Museum, and they accidentally relaunch the Apollo 11 module and go back to the moon and save the Earth from a killer asteroid using a yo-yo. And then I'm actually working on a third book where they go fishing, and they end up going to this haunted bed and breakfast that looks just like the Bates Motel. So it's a lot of little Easter eggs. But that's the project I'm working on right now. It's just third version of this graphic novel. I'm also teaching cartooning to kids through libraries all over the United States through Zoom. And I started it during COVID, and it's just been growing. It's almost like a full-time job now. Several times a week, I'll do a Zoom class. And sometimes if it's within driving distance, usually within an hour, I'll do an in-person class. But teaching kids has been spectacular. Just love doing it, being around the kids' art. It's just so honest and true. And I really enjoy, just drawing with little kids and getting them excited about cartooning. And I teach to not so much the end product, but the process, enjoying, drawing, the joy of drawing. Because there's a real tactile pleasure and joy in creating, art. And so that's what I focus on, is the creative part of it, as opposed
to the creative product. Really great. Steve, what about you?
Well, Rick was speaking a bit too quickly there. I was trying to jot down the premise of the third book so that I could steal it and get it out. I was going to ask you to speak a bit more slowly. Now, I've got two syndicated strips. I do Kid Town, which is in lots of papers. It's in the Washington Post and various other papers. That's every Sunday. I do Biographic, which is sort of a different celebrity's life story every week. That's in the New York Daily News, Boston Herald, and a few other papers. I'm working on a couple of books, basically with Luke, with my son Luke. We've got a couple of projects together, a couple of TV pitches that we're doing. We do a lot of conventions as well. I know Rick does a few.
Oh, yeah, I do a lot. This
weekend we're in, Luke and I are at DesignerCon in Las Vegas. Then 2 weeks later we're going to Tokyo Comic Con in Japan. We'll be at WonderCon in March, San Diego Comic Con in July. We do France, China, Canada. But basically, it's a lot of fun doing conventions. And so we're busy. And as I say, we're just not busy doing a daily humor strip. That's the tough sell for us, is that that's not what we're doing right now. It's kind of a callback to what we were doing 20 years ago.
Well, you know what? It sounds like it's a lot of fun, and I do have to say that I got several good laughs out of the good mullets, the strips that are on there. If you want to check out what the strips look like, go to zoop.gg/C as in cat/mullets, And there's it's going to end in the middle of December, it looks like, although they might extend it. You never know. But you get a chance to check out the book, and I highly recommend it. It's very funny. There's a lot of things. I think that it's still timely as far as what people read today. So, I highly recommend it to people. It's Mullets is what it's called, and it's the funniest comic strip you never read. The subtitle. All right. So you guys, much success with that. I hope this does shine so well that maybe you get a chance to do more Mullets in the future. That'd be fun to have this do so that well.
Yeah, your lips, God's ears.
Well, you guys have fun. Keep busy with good things because we sure need it. And thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Wayne. Appreciate it.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support this show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance.
It's not every day a comics character turns 40 and remains as relevant as ever. Megaton Man, the Complete Megaton Man Universe, Volume 1, the 1980s, launched and fully funded in 4 hours on the Zoop platform. In partnership with Fantagraphics, the legendary Don Simpson is bringing his creation to this oversized hardcover omnibus, offering over 600 pages of classic Megaton Man goodness. And I'm talking with the creator himself, Don Simpson. How you doing, Don?
Hey, how you doing, Wayne? That's a well-written press release. I'm the last to find out about these things. So,
so you didn't write this press release, I take it.
I was wondering who wrote it. They've got a good publicist. That's amazing.
Probably somebody at Zoop did that. That's what I have a feeling is what's going on. Now they actually have a paragraph where they talk about the book a little more. It says, Don Simpson's classic superhero parody and world-building multi-character epic is collected for the first time in an omnibus volume almost as bulging as the Man of Molecules' own muscles. I like that line. All issues, sequels, spin-offs, one-shots, and short stories from 1983 to 1990 are collected here, along with a plethora, and that's a word we don't hear often, of additional art, unseen sequences, various rarities, and an extensive afterword by Simpson.
Is it plethora or plethora?
I always say plethora, but
that's amazingly well written and funny, and I should delegate more of my writing to these people. this is fantastic.
Okay, very good. So I just thought that was a good way to start off and stuff. So, well, why don't we start at the beginning? It looks like it started off in 1983, and I have often thought that superheroes never get the attention they deserve. And you've gone a direction that I don't see too many do, and that is having some fun with superheroes. So talk about how you decided to go this route with Megaton Man. What happened?
Well, who do you think gets all the attention? That was certainly the case back in the 80s. The market was really dominated by Marvel and DC, and it was all superheroes. The direct market was collector shops that had been built by distributors and retailers who were basically superhero fans. You could hardly find any comics for kids, let alone for female readers. And it became completely lacking in diversity. It became almost what's monoculture. Today we take it for granted. We have so much diversity in readership, and the question is, why am I doing something superheroic? But when I started, I was making fun of all that. I was making fun of the tropes of the Silver Age that were kind of becoming very, very tired and repetitious. Marvel and DC, as I said, they not only dominated the market, but aesthetically they were just kind of bankrupt. They were running on fumes. And we started to see in the early 80s, we had the undergrounds in the 60s and 70s, and you began to see publishers like Fantagraphics who actually turned down Megaton Man a couple of times 40 years ago. But they were putting out things like Dan Klaus and the Hernandez brothers, Love and Rockets. Aardvark Vanheim, of course, was doing Cerebus, and they started doing Journey and Neil the Horse and a little thing called Normal Man, which was a superhero parody by Jim Valentino, who later became my friend. But we were kind of rivals at first because I had been working on this Megaton Man thing, and I was kind of disheartened that he beat me to it by almost a year. But yeah, I was making fun of those formulas. You had Stan Lee and the superheroes with hang-ups, the bickering, Fantastic Four, and the teenage angst of Spider-Man, and that had become mainstream, and they were already in reruns, as it were. Stan had moved on, and that generation of creators was beginning to retire. But you had people like Byrne and Perez and Marshall Rogers, who were the new generation. And as I saw it, it was just more of the same old stuff, kind of watered down. And I had kind of outgrown superhero comics by that point. And I was looking at other things. I was looking at Heavy Metal magazine, and I was looking at the alternatives and Spirit reprints from Kitchen Sink Press. Mm-hmm. And classic comic strips, European stuff, as well as hanging out at the art film houses, watching French foreign movies and so forth. We were trying to shake things up and expand a little bit from that monoculture. There was people have often said there was a kind of viciousness to my satire. I was making fun and mocking and ridiculing, with a little bit of a vengeance, as opposed to Valentino, who was really much more, just kidding around with the Silver Age. I don't know if there was a question in there or if I answered anything. But that was my mindset at the time.
Uh-huh. Well, that's why you got into it. Now, if you go to, and it's at zoop.gg/C/Megaton Man, all one word, you get to the campaign if you want to go directly there. And you get some sample pages. And there is, right off the bat, we're in interesting times, because there's Megaton Man. He's got Pammy is kneeling in front of him, of course. And he yells out, "Pammy, I faced my greatest challenge ever." And she goes, "And this is just a debut cover." And that made me laugh, because that is so funny.
I still haven't seen these sample pages. We've got 30 days left, and we've already made our goal. So hopefully there's some stretch goals. And
yeah,
see, this is all new to me. This is completely new. Crowdfunding is a new aspect to this. When I was a kid, Wayne, comic books were 20 cents. And when they went up to 25 cents, that was too much. You were always looking for the cheapest, trying to make your dollar go the heart, the furthest you could. Mm-hmm. Yep. But this is just a new world to me. Mm-hmm. And very, very instructional.
Yeah, well, a lot of comics these days are done through crowdfunding. And of course, there's Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and then there's Zoop.gg, which is a very popular one that's come along more recently. And it gets funding to people who want to create comics, because technology is there. You can, people have computers and ways to do it, and printers. Now, there are some printers who do nothing but print comic books. And so there's all these things going on, but the thing that that makes it hard is paying for the artist and paying for the printing. And so that's where crowdfunding really comes in handy, and it makes it possible for people to be able to print comics that they've made. And so it's a lot. I got a huge kick out of, because I'm looking at some of the sample pages that are on the page, and and the one guy, the bad guy, yells out, "I am called Bad Guy, mortal."
I'm literally looking at the crowdfunder page right now, and the Zoop page, and it's like, wow, this looks really impressive. You know, 40 years ago, just to have one comic book in print was like such a significant milestone, because I've been reading comics since I was 10, 1972. And to go from that, 1984, next, I'm not sure when this podcast will air, but if it's in the next few weeks, December was the release of Megaton Man number one. So it'll be probably come out exactly on the 40th anniversary. But just one comic book, it took me 13 months to write it and draw it. And I did a few pages, and then I'd think up some more stuff. And I had no world in mind. I had no... I had no world building. You'd probably talk to writers and science fiction fantasy people that spend years developing their worlds and their laws and rules of magic and fantasy and so forth. And I just was hoping that people would get the superhero conventions, you know, the newspaper and the teams, the mad scientists, and you know, a few villains. I was banking on the fact that people would recognize the tropes, the formulas.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if you ever heard the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles story. I'll tell it real quickly. Eastman and Laird had done this thing, and that was again Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That was all making fun of current trends in comics when it came.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was they got the first issue, they got it out, Diamond published it, and they were all very nice, and they said, "Oh wow, great that we got our comic out there." And then all of a sudden Diamond called them up and they said, "When is the second issue coming?" And they were like, "Second issue?" And they had no idea about that. And so they had to sit down and go, "Wait a minute, what are they going to do now? They want another issue." So they had to sit down and quickly throw something together to be the second issue of it. And of course, that's the beginning of one of the established comic book franchises, cartoons. And
well, I'll tell you something. I'll tell you something. Well, the first time I met Kevin Eastman, it was very early on. I think they may have done six issues. And he was wearing one of the Megaton Man buttons. He was literally wearing – we had – Kitchen Sink had put out a half a dozen pinback buttons that you could order in the mail. And one of them, Megaton Man, shaking his fist and he's saying, "Are you kidding? I eat X-Men for breakfast." And Kevin Eastman had one of these on when I met him. And I, you know, I was like, "Oh, that's great." And he gave me some of the early issues I ended up doing some stuff for Mirage and for the Archie Turtles, but watching that phenomenon was, pretty incredible, because they were just a couple guys with a black and white comic book and a table at a show. A lot of people are doing that now, but, you know, it pays to be a revolutionary and just not know what you're doing.
Apparently, you even had your fun with them, because in the preview pages, there's Teen Techno Turtle Trio plus one.
Yeah, that was something. Mm-hmm. That was something I did for Kevin, because he said, "Well, why don't you do? You know, we're doing an anthology. I think it was a paperback." And you know, I hadn't grown up reading the Turtles, so I didn't know anything about their narrative or their storyline. So I just made up these substitute turtles. And I said, "How about we'll tell, like, you know, tell the story of these four turtles that didn't make it. They're kind of the understudies." And Kevin loved it. Kevin was always a big fan of my work and a big supporter.
Well, like he says, you shall be known as Galileo, Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Einstein. And all of a sudden, one says, wait a minute, which one am I again? And he says, you're Casanova. And one of the turtles goes, wait a minute, nonsense, I'm Casanova. He's Don Juan. Then I must be Romeo, the first one says. And he says, trust, that must mean I'm Travolta, which made me laugh.
That's brilliant writing. I'm not going to argue with you. That is some funny stuff right there.
That made me laugh. I thought that was great stuff. So when you started doing this, you had no idea this was going to survive as long as it has, did you?
Well, I never thought of myself as a comedy writer or a humorist. I was very serious. I grew up with Steranko and Kirby and ultra dramatic. I had studied the Byrne Hogarth Dynamic Anatomy books, and I was deadly serious about the human figure and drama and Hamlet and whatever was going through my mind at the time. But as I say, I outgrew the comics themselves. Something mysterious happened as I went through high school. I knew from the age of 10 that I wanted to be a professional comic book creator, but I stopped picking up the Marvel comics because for one thing they were the quality control in the late 70s was just all over the map, but I just outgrew the superhero tropes and I was interested in more of the undergrounds and the heavy metal and so forth, and yet I somehow still thought I would be, I'm still aiming to a professional career. And by the time I started sending samples into Marvel, I really wasn't following what they had been doing for four or 5 years. Mm-hmm. The characters still looked like the characters. This was before the era where there were new costumes every 3 months, but but if you're going to ask for work from a company, you should probably keep up with what their product is. And I had no idea. So I would send in stuff to Jim Shooter, and I got a nice rejection letter, which you can't even get a response nowadays when you send stuff into a company. And I don't even know how you do that anymore. Do you mm-hmm. send them a web address, or how do you do it? Mm-hmm. But luckily, as I said, there were these publishers who were starting up their independent imprints, and Kitchen Sink had been an underground publisher and had done classic reprints, and they were looking around for a color comic because they had the spirit in color. Problem with doing color in those days, it was extremely expensive and prohibitive. And if you really wanted to make it economical, and if you wanted to get have a bargaining position with a printer, it behooved you to have a line of color comics. And I think that might be the only reason they gave me a chance. And this is not fishing for a compliment, but I was just really raw. I was really, it took me 13 months to write and draw the first issue. And then Dennis said, can you do this every other month? I said, well, sure, why not? But I had no idea. I had no storylines. I had no trajectory. I had no process. So it was a real struggle to come up with that. With that second issue and the third issue, but somehow I got it together.
Well, obviously, did you go back and start seeing where the industry was at that point? Because there's a lot of stuff that you're making fun of. I mean, the Metropolis Quartet is there, and there are obviously the Fantastic Four and other good things that you have fun with. So I was just wondering, did that prompt you to go back and look and see where comics were at that point?
Well, I'll tell you something. And a lot of people thought I was making fun of the industry of the early 80s. And I was certainly aware of what was going on. I would see new comics at the shop, go into a store every week. But I was really accessing the memory bank from when I was 10 or 12, you know, that era. And as I say, things hadn't really changed that much. You know, Franklin Richards was still a child. Peter Parker was still going to college. It was like 1980, you know, early 1980s. And from 1964 to 1984, Peter Parker was still in high school and college, 20 years. So I was just, I was really making fun of the first generation or the second generation of Marvel, the Kirbys, Ditko, Romita, Gil Kane, John Buscema. How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way came out right when I was in high school. So I was really of that earlier epoch. The X-Men phenomenon was like this new strange thing that I never quite understood. I never quite got on board with that. I was already outgrowing superheroes at that point. But by the 1980s, you know, there was Secret Wars. There were certainly things that I could make fun of for a panel or two, but not it didn't come from a very deep space, deep place in my nostalgia. Mostly what I was doing was commenting on the comics I grew up reading and had internalized. And at that point, after 10 issues, I wanted to explore these characters. So it started to veer away from a parody of the industry and making fun of the conventions and the cliches and the tropes of superheroes into much more of an exploration of character. And even though it became less frequent because after the first 10 issues, I did 7 issues of Border Worlds, which was my serious science fiction epic. And I came back to Megaton Man, but it was all very fractured. It was, I was doing freelance work, a lot of stuff for DC and for Mirage, as I mentioned, Archie Turtles, a couple of those assignments. And, I never came back to Megaton Man full time in the 80s until I made a big pile of money from Image Comics and then I could publish myself. So that'll be in volume 2. This volume 1 is all the 1980s, all the Kitchen Sink Press Megaton Man comics.
Cool. Well, let me ask a question or two just because people may not know. He's called the Man of Molecules. Why is he called that?
Well, because I thought molecules was synonymous with atomic. Oh. Even though molecules are actually made up of atoms, they're not quite interchangeable. Mm-hmm. But that was some molecular or nuclear. I obviously didn't go into STEM. So,
well, that was,
I didn't go into science and technology and math.
Well, atomic stuff was big, big, big stuff back 60s and 70s, even, I think. You know, it's just everything was, of course, the Hulk is created from a nuclear explosion with gamma radiation and all that good stuff.
Well, that was that's one of the darker aspects of Megaton Man. It was the early 80s was really the Cold War era, the Reagan, the nuclear arms race. And you have to explain to people now, because we don't hear the word megaton quite so often, but a megaton is a million tons of TNT, or the explosive force, the equivalent explosive force. Well, that's how you measure nuclear weapons. If you drop a bomb on Hiroshima or, you know, on a major city, it's a 20 megaton warhead, which is enough to flatten, you know, half the east coast of the United States. And in those days, it was a very palpable threat. And unfortunately, we're almost back to that. I was living in Detroit, and I remember Ground Zero was the term used for the bullseye. Ground Zero would have been the target. I lived in Midtown Detroit. Not far from me was the Fisher Building, which was the headquarters of the General Motors Building. That was thought to be Ground Zero. So the Russians would be targeting our our industries, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And our major cities. And so that was very much in the news. And of course, Reagan was heating up the arms race, and there was a lot of anxiety. There was the nuclear freeze movement. And at the time, I was thinking about being a cartoonist, trying to break into comics, and I came up with this exaggerated character. I wasn't sure what to call him, and he was overly muscled. He was exaggerated. He had a big M on his chest, and I wasn't sure what to name him. And then somebody blurted out Megaton, and that became his name. The whole concept really gelled from that moment on, which was the combination of Marvel Comics, the combination of the masculine tropes, the toxic masculine, overconfident Casey at the bat kind of hero, and the nuclear arms race that was going on in the early 80s.
So you had the M on his chest before you knew it was Megaton Man? Did I hear you say that?
Yeah, I was thinking of Mighty Man, or I didn't know what to call him. Man. I was going to call him Man. I don't know what it actually started with a kind of a friendly bet with my roommate, Mike Gazzala, who's an animator and cartoonist. And he worked on, he later would go on to work on Ren and Stimpy, and he would do some Fantagraphics comics, Captain Jack, and he would always appear in Critters, which was a favorite series from Kim Thompson at Fantagraphics had put out. We were just a couple of undiscovered geniuses living in Detroit because the rent was cheap. And he was doing his animation. He actually had an animation table and would occasionally shoot the little 16-millimeter sequences and so forth, and I was doing my Bern Hogarth Steranko ultra serious comic book investigations and experimentation, and we got into the, you know, these stupid fights that you get into, like, well, what's harder to do? You know, is it harder to get a laugh? Is it harder to be funny with cartooning, or is it harder to be dramatic and serious? And so as a result of these intense discussions, these playground fights, Mike tried to do serious superheroes for about 2 days. And I tried to do funny stuff. And my first attempts were really, really bad. They were kind of these watered down, archy, saccharine, sappy. I had no idea. I just, you know, nothing was working. And it was just kind of like a really bad Hallmark greeting card or something. And I finally drew this beach bum, this over-muscled beach bum, and these girls in bikinis are all draped all over him. It's kind of a Mad Magazine kind of exaggeration. And it finally got a laugh, you know. And I had something there. And so I put a costume on him, and I gave him gauntlet gloves and goggles and buttons. And, you know, he's a little bit of Thor. He's a little bit of Cyclops. He's a little bit of Superman. And, you know, just overdid every aspect of it. And I had this M on his chest, which covers his whole torso. But I didn't know. I think Mighty Man was probably the leading candidate, but as I say, when somebody's, you know, somebody said Megaton Man, it's like, oh yeah, that's it. That's the whole concept. And everything came out of that.
Huh. Now I've got to say, there's another page that makes me laugh. If you understand comics, this is just makes you laugh. There's a page, and Megaton Man is going to fly through the tear in the cosmic fabric to fight the collision, something or other, and then the words taper off. But then there's heroes or people down pointing at him and stuff, and one yells out, "It means certain death. He looks guilt stricken yet serene." This is as if this were the only way to come to terms with his unknown grief. It's to atone for some hideous secret that we would not have no way of knowing about and be at peace with himself. Boy, if that's not the X-Men, I don't know what is.
Well, here's the thing. Now, I just want to correct you. That is not Megaton Man. That is the original Golden Age Megaton Man.
Oh, okay.
So after I had the character and I thought, well, what does he do? He's got to be a newspaper reporter. He's got to work for the Manhattan Project, which is the daily newspaper. He's got to live in Megatropolis. And then, you know, what's his history? You know, well, he had an uncle who was the Golden Age Megaton Man, the original Golden Age Megaton Man. So this is actually Uncle Farley, who appears in the series. And when we first meet him, he's a broken down old guy living on Skid Row. And of course, Rex Rigid, the Liquid Man, revives him and rejuvenates him. And he becomes the Golden Age Megaton Man once again with the propeller beanie. He has this unfortunate, inappropriate relationship with one of the young X-Thems, which is the name of the X-Thems, X plus T-H-E-M-S. And so he has this this inappropriate relationship, and he's so guilt-ridden. That's actually, there was like some Kirk Douglas movie. There was a war movie where Kirk Douglas had misbehaved, and so he, to atone for his sins, he volunteers for a suicide mission against the Japanese or something like that. Anyway, that's the idea. And so he's going to fly into the cosmic terror and face the unknown. And we never see him again, except we do see him. You know, nothing is ever final in a comic book. You can kill these characters off multiple times and they keep coming back.
Right. There's no such thing as death. If you die, you come back anyway.
So there's only early retirement followed by a reboot.
That's right. So all these good things are in there. It's like hundreds of pages in this initial book, and it goes through until the end of until 1990 is what I see, and I'm just I'm intrigued. Is that so? I guess the other books will. How many decades did Megaton Man come out, or are you still making Megaton Man?
Well, so the 1980s is an interesting. Obviously, that was the first decade. December of 84 is when the first issue came out. So it's really 85 to 90, and we did 10 bi-monthly issues, and then it was a little more sporadic. For the next interval. So there was another six Kitchen Sink Comics. And all those are being collected now, and I'm really looking forward to that aspect of it, because everything had to be a number one. And I talk about that in the afterword, the sad history behind the scenes. But everything had to be a number one. Megaton Man meets the X-Thems number one. Then there was Yarn Man number one. And I had to count on my fingers, you know, how many issues were there, because I could never keep it straight. If we just kept the numbering, it would have been so much easier. But all 16 issues will be collected. That's the first volume, 500 pages. Plus, there's all kinds of unpublished artwork. And the original Golden Age Megaton Man is from one of those one-shots, as a matter of fact. And then we throw in some other stuff like the Teen Techno Turtle Trio, which I own. And that kind of completes the whole Volume 1. Volume 2 will be the 1990s, and that was after I did a couple of very lucrative projects for Image Comics, including Splitting Image and the Savage Dragon versus the Savage Megaton Man. If you remember the Image Comics phenomenon, that was incredible print runs, incredible revenue, lots of money, lots of money. And so I had enough. I had enough money from doing a very small amount of work to publish my own series. And I probably should have just done Megaton Man, but I wanted to expand my universe. So I called it Bizarre Heroes, and I had a bunch of characters from junior high school that I brought back. And but inevitably, Megaton Man and his cast took over after a few issues. So I did another 17 issues of Bizarre Heroes. But you might as well have called it Megaton Man after a certain point, because it just they just took over. So that'll be volume two. And we will be reprinting the Savage Dragon team up in that volume. Eric Larson has granted permission for that. So you have that to look forward to. That takes care of the 1990s. Then there's a long, dark period, Wayne. A long, dark period of my life. I went back to college. Oh. And after September 11th, 2001, I decided I'm going back to college. And I studied art history. Hmm. I actually got a degree and did a little teaching and so forth. But the last 10 years, I have actually gravitated back to cartooning, and I've done a lot with Megaton Man, which is nobody's more surprised than I am, because as I said, I always thought of Megaton Man as kind of a warm-up act for something else. I thought I would do something really serious, really important, something more dramatic. In fact, when Eric Larson suggested we do a team up, I said, well, you know, why do you want to team up with Megaton Man? That's a humor character. Why don't you guys are all doing serious superheroes. Why don't I do something cool and, you know, like Shadowhawk or like Youngblood, or, you know, I'll do something serious and dramatic. Oh, no. Eric wanted to do a team up with Megaton Man. Wow. And in any case, here I am 40 years later, and all the material I've been working on for quite some time has been related to Megaton Man. So I've got a lot of stuff in the pipeline. If these things go, and it looks like the Zoop has been a success so far, hopefully the second one, and then we have some volumes planned after that. I have quite an inventory of material and new storylines that I'm working on. The irony is that I didn't really approach Megaton Man as a world building storyline. I didn't have a real story arc in mind. But the last few years, I've done a lot of work on figuring out how does Megaton Man relate to the Golden Age Megaton Man? What's the family tree? What are these other characters? What's the history from World War II into the 70s? And I've done an enormous amount, an unbelievably staggering amount of geeky world building. And some of that is going to come out in the stories that I'm doing. I've got them up to, I've got the characters up to the 1990s. It's, I know their ages now. I know their birth dates. I think of them by their first names. In fact, I don't, when you refer to Megaton Man, I think of Trent, Trent Flug, his secret identity. So I call him Trent. I'm on a first name basis with my characters now. And Stella, the see-through girl, is Stella. And they've got a boy, they've got a little son named Simon. And even Yarn Man, I think of him by his civilian name, which is Bing. Cosmic Cat has become a major character. Pamela Jointly and Preston Percy are still around. Preston is losing his hair. He used to have the flowing kind of, you know, the big hair piled up on top of his head. Now he's losing his hair. Ms. Megaton Man, Clarissa James, has become a very important character. So I have a great deal more understanding of these characters and their inner relationships. And I'm not really so concerned to make fun of the industry or to make fun of superheroes per se. I'm much more interested in the involvement and the humor that arises from the private lives of these characters who are trying to live in this complicated world of ours. Even though they are super powered or mega powered, as I call it, and they wear funny costumes, but they still have they're still very human to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, because a lot of the times when characters are developed in an imagination of somebody, they take on a life of their own. They start acting in your head like they're real. And I have a feeling it sounds like that's what's happening with the Megaton Man cast, that all kinds of good things like that are going on.
Well, yeah, and like I said, that is the last, the nobody's more surprised than I am. It hasn't gotten to the level of auditory hallucination, but I can almost write their dialogue in my sleep. I will go that far to say.
Well, while we've been talking, I thought you'd like to know, you've gained 4 supporters, and we're not broadcasting, we're recording ahead of time. So, actually, you just got another one. You have passed the $10,000 mark while we're talking.
Holy mackerel.
So, I dare say this is going over quite well, and I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more Megaton Man in the future, because, boy, you are just, this is just taking off like crazy.
We're going to have to raise our goals. We have to be more ambitious. I think we should. We'll see where this ends. But that is the thing that I'm very optimistic about, is not only that all fans, you know, the fans from the 80s will get to relive those comics, but hopefully a new audience will discover these characters.
I don't think it's going to be time locked either. I think that people are going to be able to appreciate them as they are today, because the comics haven't changed all that much, I'm sorry to say.
Well, you know, there were certain, here's the funny thing, certain aspects of the series were ahead of their time. And I'll give you an example, because I mentioned Kitchen Sink Press had been an underground publisher. And the comic book industry in those days was still very much under the Comics Code authority. There was a kind of a G-rated regime that Marvel and DC was under. And that's broken down considerably in the last few decades. And you've certainly seen Marvel and DC do much more mature themes and so forth. But we were kind of all alone. I mean, Fantagraphics, Love and Rockets were exploring some mature themes with Maggie and Hopi and with Gilbert's work, Palomar, and so forth. But at Kitchen Sink Press, as I say, which had been an underground publisher, there had been sex and drugs and politics, and Megaton Man had never been explicitly following in those footsteps, but we weren't exactly constrained by the Comics Code either. So I had the see-through girl who could turn naked with but a thought, and I would have occasional language, and I certainly had mature relationships, because, and I was just trying to be funny, you have to understand. But right off the bat, Megaton Man has an affair with the See-Through Girl, and See-Through Girl is married to Liquid Man. They are members of the Megatropolis Quartet. So basically, Superman is having an affair with the Invisible Girl. That was kind of the idea. And I just thought, well, that would be funny. And but then after you do that joke, you think, okay, well, then what happens? And in issue 9, I have the see-through girl return to town, and she is with child. So again, I thought, well, that would be funny if she shows up pregnant and there's Megaton Man in the middle of a fight scene. You know, the partiers from Mars are landing in Central Park, and here's his old girlfriend, his fling that he had, and she tells him she's about to deliver a child. Uh-oh. Again, not thinking ahead, not really planning ahead. But then when the series ended at 10 issues, Megaton Man loses his powers. And when I decided to do more Megaton Man stories, I had a new plot. I had a new dramatic question. What's going to happen now? He's lost his powers. He goes off to the college town, and his old flame is about to have a child. And I didn't even know what their relationship was like or how to even describe it. Now, today, you would call it, you know, parenting partners, right? You know, people that are raising a child, not necessarily in a romantic relationship, not necessarily married. But there wasn't even language for that in the 80s. We were still very, very taciturn about those kinds of issues. The fact that we had a president who was divorced was shocking and scandalous. I'm speaking of Reagan at the time, but now, you know, the world has caught up to us, but we actually had a chance to license Megaton Man. This would have been early 90s, around the time the Image Comics was going on. We had somebody interested in licensing Megaton Man who thought it was a children's book or a family-friendly book. And then they sat down and read them. And they said, hey, you know, your title character has had a child out of wedlock with a married woman, and she's not even divorced, and they're not getting married, but they live in the same house with other people. What is this? What kind of communist thing is this? It's this new age family, extended family structure. So we literally lost out on a lucrative licensing deal because it was considered so shocking. Now I don't think you could even, you know, that doesn't even qualify as scandalous now. I mean,
nobody would bat an eye now, I don't think.
So in that sense, we were ahead of our time and the world is kind of caught up with us. Mm-hmm. In other respects, as I said, you know, geopolitically, we still have the same tensions, and we still have nuclear weapons all around the world. Mm-hmm. So, fun times.
Mm. Well, I've got two questions for you before I let you go. He yells out "woo." Why?
That's right.
What? Why is that? Is that his catchphrase?
I'll tell you, and I don't quite know. You know, people, fans. I run into fans at shows, and they'll shout "woo," and they'll try different voicings and intonations. And I don't really know. Does he say "woo"? Does he say "woo"? Does he shout? Does he scream? Is it a high pitched whine? I don't know. It just looked funny. Is a word that you would read quietly to yourself. But it just became his catchphrase, you know. I think his son says "wow." Simon says "wow." Ms. Megaton Man tends to say "whoa," as in WHOA. But you rely on those catchphrases. Yarn Man would say things like "golly, that crazy gizmo really works." And if it's funny once, mm-hmm. you just keep using it. Mm-hmm. Or how do we know this isn't a crummy imposter? You know, that's so you just find these catchphrases and just keep milking them.
Okay, well, one last question. I don't know. I've got to be really careful about how I ask this. The one thing I've always worried about, and Superman has had children now with Lois Lane and stuff like that, but a lot of people have questioned how that's possible.
Hmm.
Because, you know, to be gentle about it, certain.
Well, let me tell you something, Wayne. I know my characters pretty well, but I don't know them that well. Okay. So I don't know. Okay. I don't know. How do they manage that? How does that work? The birds and the bees, yeah. Well, see, there are flowers and there's pollen and a bumblebee comes along and, the birds chirp. I don't know how to explain it to you any better than that.
Okay. Well, but I get that. Because that thing always puzzles me, but I just don't understand how Lois Lane survives such a thing. But anyway, that's comics for you. But so the Complete Megaton Man, let me get the title. The Complete Megaton Man Universe, Volume 1, the 1980s. And as we're talking, it's already a success, and it's going to get even more successful. They don't even have stretch goals listed in here. It says coming soon stretch goals.
Well, you can get all kinds of stuff. You can get autographed book plate. Mm-hmm. You can get a sketch, an actual drawing, ink drawing, pen and ink. I'll be happy to do that for the right price. And we're also doing a print. We're doing a limited edition print. They also have some other add-ons. So, but hopefully people will just like the book, just read the book and from cover to cover, you'll get the complete history of the first decade of Megaton Man. And hopefully it will hold together after all, after 40 years.
Well, I have to say, I mean, right now, as we're standing, the PDF is $50 and three people, as we're talking, by the time this post is probably a lot more. But there's 46 people have claimed the early bird special of $74 for the hardcover, deluxe hardcover. And wow. Then there's one person's claimed the $95 one. But the big one is out of 25 of the 125 version, 22 of those are already claimed in the first day or two.
The Raymarked. I don't even know what a Raymark is. No, I know what a Raymark is.
Now I'm sure you do because
look at that. Wow. You can get the other Fantagraphics stuff. You can get there's a retailer bundle.
Wow.
Wow. And there's more where that came from. They can print as many of these as they want, and I can keep drawing.
That's right. It's 608 pages. It says it is over 10,000 as the dollars as we are talking. And Don, I think you got a big success on your hand. I am looking forward to. I can't wait to see how much this actually completely raises when the time comes. Now, one thing we should mention. One of the things I never like about Zoop is they never tell you. Other crowdfunders will have an exact day and an exact time when things end. This just says as we're talking, I have to do math every time. It says 30 days as we're talking, and it's on the date that it is. It's going to be around middle of December. Middle of December.
So 30 days, it was about the 10th of December 10th, I guess.
Yeah, roughly so. So that's, and that, they might even, if it's going really well and they decide that they could make some more money, they might even extend that. So that's good things going on. So, Don, I think you got a hit on your hands. I think there's great things coming for this. And the funniest part is you haven't even seen it. That's the fun.
Well, it's long overdue, I'll tell you. It's long overdue, and I'm looking forward to, there's more where that came from. So that's fantastic. Yeah, $7,500, $10,000. We're over 33% over what the goal was. Wow, I can do that kind of math.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
See, I can't do that, so I have to respect your math abilities there. So
wow.
I can tell you, Don, you've got something great going on here. So just keep it up.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Wayne. It was good talking to you, and I look forward to listening back to this audio only podcast.
Well, maybe next time, maybe when Volume 2 comes out, we'll do this again.
All right, fair enough.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time when we'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
End results aside, we are not happy. You hacked Justice League systems, disobeyed direct orders, and endangered lives. You will not be doing this again.
I am sorry, but we will.